our collective nightmare, a man in a light blue shirt, striped tie, and khakis walked into a Utah courtroom, and the country pretended that counting chairs and camera angles was the same thing as justice. Tyler Robinson, 22, who authorities say killed a public figure at a college event last September, made his first in-person appearance since he turned himself in the day after the shooting. The formal details are already boring and terrible. Aggravated murder, firearm felonies, obstruction, witness tampering, and a violent act in front of a child. A 3-day preliminary hearing is set for May 18, 2026, because calendars still matter even when the larger story smells like collapse. The hearing wasn't about the crime so much as how much of the public can watch the ritual of deciding what the public can see. An earlier October session on courtroom security and media rules was closed. Media outlets asked for a transcript. Defense and state lawyers suggested redactions. The judge closed the first part of Thursday's hearing for more than 2 hours so grown-ups could argue in private about what will be visible to everyone else. The court then scolded the lone camera in the room for showing shackles, picking up attorney-client talk and photographing papers on the defense table, and moved it so the production values matched the official narrative. The scene on the campus where the shooting happened is now a crime scene photograph and a political artifact. Investigators say a bolt-action rifle and related items were found in nearby woods. DNA on those items matched the accused, and prosecutors say there was a confession in private messages. The cartridges were engraved with lines from memes and video games. The small dumb jokes of the internet turned into evidence at the scene of a killing. Parents recognized their son from surveillance photos and went with him to turn him in. Prosecutors intend to seek the death penalty, because we will always escalate to the most final option when things go sideways enough. Erica Kirk was given the legal status that grants her fuller access as a victim representative, and she pushed for cameras to limit conspiracies. Transparency was requested like it was a civic prayer. Instead, the court treated transparency like a liability to be negotiated, sealed, and edited. The judge will consider banning cameras at a hearing in January, which feels like scheduling televised opacity into law. There is motive in the papers. A message to intimates about being done with a kind of hate, and family testimony about a son becoming more political and more supportive of rights for gay and trans people. Those facts will be parsed, excused, weaponized, and misread in endless loops. The accused is charged with an act that ruptures a campus speech event into a murder scene. The dead man had made a career out of loud, brash conservatism and debating opponents into content. His latest book about Sabbath and transformation hits shelves this week, as if print could quiet the static. This is a case about a killing, about evidence, about whether a televised country will watch itself being judged. It is also a country deciding how public it wants to be about its own violence. Cameras, redactions, sealed hearings, engraved meme cartridges. The machinery of modern life keeps ticking while the meaning of any of it drifts away. The preliminaries continue. The arguments over access continue, and the rest of us keep scrolling through the receipts.
First world problems. The University of Michigan fires its head coach after an investigation finds an inappropriate relationship, then hours later is booked in the county jail. The nation reacts like it's the season finale of a prestige drama, except the main cliffhanger is who's going to coach the bowl game. Sharon Moore, first Black head coach in program history, 2 seasons, memorable upsets, suddenly terminated with cause. That phrase reads like a legal memo and a soap opera subtitle. The university issues its lawyer-friendly zero-tolerance statement, while the university's athletic director gets the modern miracle. A mid-season hiring market that resembles Black Friday at an Ivy League mall. Pick of the litter, the press release says, because nothing screams dignity like describing billion-dollar coaching jobs as puppy adoption. Meanwhile, the coaching carousel won't pause for paperwork or people. Lane Kiffin's tap dance continues, contracts get renegotiated, and every mid-tier coach who just signed an extension becomes the subject of fevered speculation. The real national emergency, apparently, is the trickle-down effect. If Michigan grabs Coach A, then Coach B moves, then Coach C bolts. And before you know it, Indiana is recruiting for a job that wasn't on the map last week. It's like fantasy football, but with salaries and moral ambiguity. Let's not confuse disbelief with indifference. An alleged assault is being investigated. Arraignment may be next. And those are serious matters. But the public conversation has two tracks, one legal, one logistical. And the logistics are pure first world. Will Michigan make a splash hire before the transfer portal opens on January 2nd? Will Biff Podgy keep the team intact for a New Year's Eve bowl? That's the headline that keeps people up at night. We are living in a world where a possible criminal case is overshadowed by a staffing strategy and a bowl game itinerary. Now that is a first world problem.
A federal judge ordered Kilmar Abrego Garcia released from ICE this week because, in the slow motion chaos that passes for immigration enforcement, someone finally noticed there was no lawful order to keep him locked up. He had already been wrongly deported to El Salvador, sent back to the U.S., charged with helping smuggle migrants, released, re-detained, and then shoved into a legal purgatory while officials tried to invent a country to send him to next. The administration's plan looked less like border policy and more like a bureaucratic parlor trick. Announce removal to Uganda, Eswatini, Ghana, none of which had been properly asked to accept him, while ignoring the one country that had agreed, Costa Rica. The judge found that Abrego Garcia was being held to effectuate a third country removal without any lawful basis, and ordered his immediate release. In response, a Homeland Security spokesperson called the ruling naked judicial activism, which is how a government sounds when it confuses being questioned with being obstructed. Abrego Garcia's lawyers picked him up at a Pennsylvania facility. He'll soon reunite with family, but freedom comes with strings. Strict pretrial conditions in a Tennessee smuggling case, custody under his brother in Maryland, strict travel limits, and a January trial date. He has pleaded not guilty and is asking for the charges to be tossed. This episode is not an unfortunate anomaly. It's the playbook. Move fast, ignore paperwork, manufacture removals, then blame judges who point out the rules. The spectacle of a man deported by mistake, returned, and then paraded around the globe on paper demonstrates the real policy, force without accountability. It isn't merely cruel or incompetent, it's a rehearsed routine that normalizes law as an optional suggestion. The rest of us get to watch as administration and courts argue over who gets to pretend the rules still matter.
This piece is based on a CNN article titled, "The Deeply Personal Reasons Why Many Indiana Senate Republicans Said No to Trump." Sometimes the grand narratives we tell ourselves, loyalty, power, winning, get interrupted by things that are, frankly, smaller and truer. A 76-year-old grandmother talks at her grandson's school. Her grandson walks into basketball practice and learns that the other kids got nasty texts about his grandma. He blushes. She laughs it off. That evening, she gets angry. The next day, she decides to say no. If you want a reminder that human beings are not ideological machines, that will do. You can command rallies and post threats. You can redraw maps until your hands cramp. But you cannot legislate the tiny, embarrassing, stubborn fact of being a person who loves other people. There's delicious irony in a political campaign built on loyalty tests being undone by loyalty to actual human beings. Senators who voted for the same president three times find that the abstract calculus of power collapses when someone attacks a child, when a slur is hurled at a person with Down syndrome, when swatting calls terrorize your neighborhood. It's petty and noble at the same time, petty because it's about hurt feelings and text messages, noble because it's about protecting dignity. Politics often runs on the premise that public life can be outsourced to strategy firms and hot takes. But private life has this weird habit of barging in. You can threaten primaries from a podium in Washington. You can name names on social media. You can fly in surrogates and air hostile ads. That all looks powerful until a room full of neighbors, voters, and grandchildren remind you that maps are drawn by people and for people, not as armor against conscience. The story is funny if the stakes weren't real. The spectacle of pressure campaigns backfiring because they were mean-spirited feels like watching a sitcom where the villain misreads the script and trips on the rug. The comedy is thin when those missteps include threats and acts of violence. The tragic part is that the same systems that encourage cruelty also depend on ordinary decency to function. There is some small comfort in realizing that not everything can be bought with influence. Human beings still respond to simple moral cues. Don't be mean to kids. Don't mock people with disabilities. Don't terrorize your neighbors. Those cues are old-fashioned. They are inconvenient. They also work. If politics is theater, then sometimes the most radical act is refusing to participate in the cruelty the script demands. A vote against a map isn't a policy paper. It's a line in a life story where someone says, "No, not like this." That moment is small, messy, and utterly human. So we keep drawing lines on maps and making threats and pronouncing strategy. Meanwhile, a grandmother, a worried dad, a threatened neighbor remind us that the thing that matters most is not the map, it's the people who live inside it. That is both comforting and mildly absurd, which is, frankly, the best you can hope for in a political era built on big slogans and fragile egos.
The capitalist's fever dream. The adults in charge have agreed on the costume for the next act. Cheap credit and patriotic tariffs, sold as salvation. In 2025, with Donald Trump back in the White House, the show is as simple as it is cynical. Tell people prices are a leftover from someone else's mistakes, cut interest rates, and watch consumption pretend to be confidence. Both the president and the Federal Reserve chair marched out the same talking points, one with bluster and the other with beige authority. That alignment is not a sign of competence, it's a symptom. When the man who insulted the Fed's independence and the man who was supposed to guard it start singing from the same hymn sheet, the music is meant to soothe markets, not heal households. The story they've sold to Americans is neat and tidy. The true wound was inflation during the previous administration. That wound is mostly scar tissue now. What people feel in their wallets is delayed pain. Fix it by flooding the economy with cheaper loans so paychecks can play catch-up. Tariffs get framed as stern protectionism that will not keep raising prices forever. It's a political math trick made of smoke and slogans. Nobody mentions the obvious cost of this trick. Lowering rates props up spending and asset prices. It props up corporate profits and stock portfolios while adding oxygen to any price pressures that still simmer. It extends the moment when the system can look like it's working. Until it moves on to the next crisis. That's not a policy. It's a performance aimed at midterm cycles and balance sheets. Tariffs are presented as tough love for American industry, but they are also a piggy bank. They let the state look strong while corporations pass the bill to consumers. They raise entry prices for everyday goods and give markets the excuse to hike profits. Claiming they won't be inflationary over the long run is a comfort for investors. And a lie of omission for people who pay at the register. The Fed chair speaks in measured sentences about trade-offs and supporting the labor market. The president hollers that inflation is history, or a hoax depending on the audience. It would be funny if it weren't so deliberate. One side polishes the language, the other polishes the headline. Both are selling the same product. Short-term relief, long-term exposure to the next shock. This is how capitalism now solves political risk. When prices bite, create the illusion of relief with lower borrowing costs. When politics requires theater, pass tariffs and blame previous administrations. When voters need a story they can clap for, provide a villain and an easy fix. The real victims are the steady earners, the renters, the people whose wages creep up only after a recession has already eaten their savings. The Fed's independence has been treated like a flexible prop, bent when the stage manager calls for it. That matters because independence exists to prevent this very theater. When central banking becomes a tool for electoral calm rather than economic stability, the crowd applauds while the foundations crumble. Corporate America watches these signals and does what it always does, plan for profit. Lower rates mean cheap capital for share buybacks, mergers, and luxury hires at the top. Tariffs mean guaranteed margins for protected suppliers. Consumers, exhausted and indebted, are expected to spend their way back to optimism while executives pocket the upside. What passes for policy becomes a feedback loop of spectacle. The government promises affordability by making credit easier to obtain. People borrow to cover the gap between wages and prices. Markets rally. Politicians claim success. The next shock, a jump in rents, a supply stumble, international turmoil. Resets the panic and the cycle starts again, dressed in new slogans. This fever dream is not about fixing economic pain. It's about managing perceptions long enough to keep profits flowing and votes pliable. The most unlikely compromises between presidents and technocrats are useful only insofar as they preserve that flow. For everyone else, The system asks for patience, adjustment, and the quiet acceptance of rising costs that are always someone else's fault. The price of that patience is a steady erosion of trust and a growing deficit of real relief.